Okay, all flight controllers, go, no go for landing. Retro.
Go,
I
don't go.
Titan, go.
GNC,
go.
Econ,
go.
Control,
go.
Ninth Planet Audio.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
So have we been rolling?
Yeah.
Welcome. Welcome to tentatively titled Turek Books Podcast. You know, anyone who loves books lives with the sadness that they're not going to be able to read all the books they ever want to read. And while that is sad, there is, I believe, a way of experiencing books through hearing other people talk about them. And so that's sort of the genesis of this show. And who better to kick things off with than Dr. Amy Silverberg? She's a professor, a comedian, a writer, and she's good at all of them.
Wow, that's so nice of you to say. Thank you for having me. I will say I adjunct, so nobody, I don't have a tenured, but just making sure, you know.
Okay. She's really good at writing and comedy.
And I adjunct at currently USC and UCLA and a few other places. So.
Okay.
Thank you for having me. I love you. It's not every day you see a smart and good-looking comedian bookman.
Yeah, I got like 6 more months while both of those still say
you have one good summer
true.
Left.
Yeah, I got
Carol
one good summer.
Set. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're trying to pack in a bunch of episodes before the hair starts falling out. But yeah, I'm so excited to see the books that you brought.
I know I brought too many.
No,
once
never
you start
too many.
Going through your shelves to pick the books that really mean to you, each book means something to you. Each book kind of reminds me of a time in my life. It reminds me of a different author who I once wanted to be, you know. I feel like so much of writing is writing towards someone.
And so for you, you would often write towards authors?
Yeah, and I think these are authors that when I first read them, it was like, oh, I didn't even know that you could do that. I didn't know that that constituted literature. I feel like when I was growing up, I read good the stuff I read that was most moving to me, I read on my own. You know, the school stuff, I guess I liked The Great Gatsby, but I don't remember that as well as I did, like, the books I found.
Yeah.
And I think I was under the impression that great literature was, like, Hemingway, you
yes.
know? Like, you had to be a dude in a boat. And then stories I read where it was, like, a woman at a party. And I just thought, I can't believe a woman at a party thinking about her ex-boyfriend can be literature, you know, or in a story in this. It's called Virgins. It's about a 15-year-old girl losing her virginity. And it's just stuff where you're like, I have felt that. You read it and you think, oh, you said it. You said something I've always felt and I wouldn't have known how to put it into words until I read it like this. I think it makes you feel known and understood and less alone.
Yes. Yeah, books kind of reveal our private lives and let
totally.
Us understand that, oh, no, that's actually a public thing,
totally.
Because we're all kind of going through it.
Totally. And I think one of the things I'm interested in comedy and in fiction is this idea of like low culture mixed with high culture. I just taught a short story from The New Yorker by Miranda July called The Metal Bowl. Have you heard of it?
No, I've probably read it. I've read all of
a lot
books.
Of it. Yeah. So this is a story from 2018 or something. And it's about a woman who like does porn, you know, once in her life. And she's talking about like coming into a bowl, but it's this great, poignant, moving literature. And I think that's what I'm interested in is how do we combine cum and poignancy and literature.
And bowls.
The metal
bowl.
It's so good.
Your character's going to come in.
Yeah, exactly.
My sister, she's like this very talented musician, but she also started a side job where she's like a handy woman. And Miranda July just got one of her ads out of a yoga studio and hired her to build a fence. And I was like, Britt, be careful. She's going to, like, make you one of her quirky characters.
Yeah, or you'll fall in love with her.
Yeah, or you'll fall in love with her,
yeah.
Which from the sound of it, yeah, it's
yeah,
not
she's
too
a great
far.
Novel, too. Really kind of voice-driven, fun. I'm
yeah,
interested
the first
in,
bad man.
Yeah,
right?
The first bad man.
Yeah.
I'm interested in those voices that manage to be funny and sad at the same time. I think it's what imitates life. I know you're interested in being funny and sad at the
yeah.
same time. How do those two things dovetail together?
Well, I think like I'd prefer to just be sad, but like humor is the like spoonful of sugar that
yes.
makes the medicine.
Yeah,
go down.
Yeah, yeah. I also think adding some humor to it makes the sad sadder and
Yeah.
And it makes the funnier.
Somehow, after a really good laugh. There's a scene in the movie adaptation where Meryl Streep's like laughing at a dinner party. And then she like goes into the bathroom and shuts the door and stares at herself in the mirror. And she like starts crying. And it's like we all know that moment.
Right.
That feeling of like, this joy isn't going to last.
Right. I think when you pick up a book, there's a story in... Can I talk about the book?
Please.
There's a story in this, Lori Moore, Birds of America. It's called People Like This Are the Only People Here, I think. I just taught it. I'm embarrassed. I think I have dementia that I can't remember the title. But it's about a woman whose baby has cancer and is in the cancer ward. And I think it's based on an experience Lori Moore went through. But it's so funny. And it's,
wow.
You know, she's thinking about the baby having its own little baby demented thoughts while it's in this cancer ward. And I wouldn't want to read a story about a baby who has cancer, but I do want to read a story in which a baby has cancer and it manages to be funny.
And
then somehow more heartbreaking because it's funny.
And the art in making that funny is insane.
Yes, although I think it is truly has something to do with the way you move through the world. And I know anytime I've tried to be funny in a short story, editors will circle it and be like, this is you wedging in a joke, you know? Because
right.
I think it has to come kind of purely from the character moving through the world.
This is a great book for you to bring because I've actually read it. There's a story in there where a woman and her mom are on a road trip in Scotland to go kiss this stone, right? It's
a
tradition. You hang off of a cliff and you kiss a stone. And
yeah.
It always stuck with me. I thought it was so good.
Yeah.
Lori Moore is one of those people who just, man... She can really nail a short story.
Yeah, I think you read Lori Moore and you're like, this is the version of myself that I've always thought I was but couldn't describe. You know, it's like it feels like I'm reading an alternate version of myself if I was more eloquent and funny and smart.
Well, George Saunders talks about that in his book. He's like, I wish I was as good as my best moments in my writing.
Yes. Oh, that's so, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, people meet me and they expect me to be my pinnacle as a writer. And he's like, no, that's just like what I want to be too, and I'm not.
I shouldn't say this because I'm jinxing myself, but probably helpful to talk about here. I sold a novel and I'm having a really hard time because I think I've been a short story writer most of my life. And somehow the shift into trying to write a novel... and I think part of it is that feeling of like I'm being really self-conscious in the way I'm writing. Normally when I write a short story, nobody's waiting for it. I just finish it and then I send it around. In this novel, I feel like everybody is waiting for it to be done. So every line I write, I picture my hands like little claws, you know, being like and then I haven't been able to get into this kind of flow state, I think, just having fun. And I always think about this quote that George Saunders says about writing, where he's like, I'm not a genius. I don't know that much about writing. I just think when I get to the end of a sentence, do I want to read the next sentence? Like, that's all I can. So I keep trying to think, because that's what I'm interested in, short stories. I think I'm writing to voice and rhythm, not to plot.
Right.
And in a novel, I get all caught up in where's this going? What's the plot? I'm on the second draft, and the first draft had no plot. So people told me. So I'm trying to just concentrate on sentence by sentence.
Yeah, it reminds me of something David Mamet said about filmmaking. He just said, like, a movie is a series of uninflected images.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and so that word uninflected.
This is a podcast where Josh and I are just going to quote things back to each other until we've quoted everything.
I think we can work and burn our way through. But you had said earlier, like, something about how writing with someone in mind is really valuable to you.
I think I'm writing with myself and like a younger version of myself who could have used these short stories.
Right.
You know?
And so I think, what if you just applied that to the novel instead of all the people who are waiting on
it? Yeah, the like
said,
outer
like, hey,
noise.
How about I just write it to the same person who I want to write it to?
Yeah, I think you're right. Sometimes I think about I think about myself in college. I was like depressed, but I think we're in the generation where like now my college students are all like, I made a documentary about why I can't come on antidepressants. And I'm like, I didn't even know. We didn't even know what depression was, you know.
No.
I was in a sorority. I was like sleeping with men who didn't care if I lived or died, you know, and wanted to be a writer, wanted to be a comedian, but wasn't like doing it. I went to this big party college. I'm a type 1 diabetic, so I couldn't drink the way that everybody could drink, but I was still sort of like, I just remember going to frat parties and feeling trapped. Like, it did not occur to me that I could just leave, you know?
Right.
All this to say, and I had, nobody knew that I was like depressed. I had all of these sorority girl friends and who are still my friends, but like books were my solace, you know? And I would like sit and just, I was waiting until the time that I could, like, I guess, do it myself. I think a lot of people find themselves in college. I'm like a late bloomer.
Yeah.
Took me a while. And I think when I sit and write, I'm like writing towards that, like,
that
young,
depressed
version of myself.
What did we call depression back then? Get over it?
I think I thought
just,
everybody
like,
had trouble getting out of bed. And I would call my mom, who was very nice, but she's still sort of old school. And she'd be like, just take a walk, you know?
Yeah, take a walk. You know,
take
it's
a
something
walk.
You're not doing.
Yeah.
It couldn't possibly be the crushing weight of like capitalism and the fact
right.
that we're in a very unnatural
Oh, I was like in love with
existence.
My roommate too. Just like
okay.
all sorts of things that I couldn't say aloud, you know, that I was like.
That we're going to make like a perfect short story.
Exactly.
And what college was it?
UC Santa Barbara.
Yeah,
University
UCSB.
Of Casual Sex and Beer. You can study best. Yeah, a lot of. That's why I had to go to so much school after. I was so drunk, you know.
The whole time.
Yeah.
As a type 1 diabetic.
As a
type
1 diabetic,
like
and I shouldn't have
conflict
been.
There.
Yes.
You're a type 1
yes.
diabetic at yes. a drinking school.
Yes.
In a,
it chose to be in a sorority, too. You know, who knows why.
And this was like the peak of binge drink culture. Like,
oh,
because
yeah.
you teach kids now. I don't think they binge drink like we
yeah,
did
I mean, they,
15,
USC,
20.
Like, sororities and fraternities are a big thing, but they just seem so much like more with it than
right.
I. Sometimes
yeah,
too
things.
With it. They know things. They all are like on the. They all have diagnosed themselves with a million things or have gotten diagnosed with a million things.
I didn't even have Thai food till I was like 23.
They're like, sorry, that's appropriation. You know,
yeah.
they're all on top of things.
Yeah, it's a totally different self-awareness.
Yes.
I have a 23-year-old sister, and she, like, doesn't have her driver's license.
Oh, yeah.
Sees no reason to, you know,
yeah,
and it's
yeah,
like
yeah.
those things, like, culturally are just
They're
so
like,
different.
I'm asexual, and I'm like, what is happening, you know? When I was in college, we were like, I'm Samantha.
Yeah, it's wild. I didn't go to college. I actually lived in a woman's little woman's decaying house for a while, like
a
20 years ago in Beverly Hills up a canyon.
That's
it was
a college
called,
of its own.
Yeah. And
you,
I found the ad in like a UCLA newspaper, $500 for the room. It was smaller than this. And like it was, I think of this because I worked on this street that we're on right now 20 years ago.
Mm.
And her name was Abby Franklin. She had an oxygen tank because she had just had a stroke. She lived on Franklin Canyon Avenue, and she said, it only took me 3 marriages to get the same last name as my street.
That's what a good character.
Yeah, she was, you know,
Did
really
you
charming.
Always want, were you always interested in writing?
Yeah, I was, because I'm a failed child actor.
Oh, I've always forgot.
Yeah, and so the story, you know, when you're a failed actor, you either get into real estate or you start writing scripts. And so
yeah,
I started
yeah,
doing
yeah.
that at 17. But even pre that, I remember being a kid. I loved reading books. And I remember thinking, how do you sell books? How do you make the same copies over and over? Because I didn't know that copy machines were
yeah.
a thing. So I like had a stack of paper and I was like, okay, I'm going to write a 20-page book and I'm just going to do it over and over again so that I can sell my book to people.
You were doing like zines.
Zines, yeah.
yeah.
I was like in my closet at
yeah.
6 years old making a zine.
That's so I don't know how young I was. Young. I wrote it was like for show and tell, I wrote a little book about O.J. Simpson. And I had only sort of heard what was happening, you know, through periphery.
Yeah, it was just always on the news.
Yeah, and my parents talking about it. And I titled it O.J. Simpson, Man or Murderer. It didn't occur to me
Whoa.
That you could be both a man or murderer. It was wild. There was like squirrels with like thought bubbles who were like, did he kill? Did
oh
he kill?
God.
Yeah, they called my parents. And my parents, who were like totally neglectful but supportive, we're like, let her do
cook.
Her thing. Yeah,
let
her cook. Yeah, my mom was like, I think it's funny.
She's speaking to the moment
exactly.
right now. Why are you trying?
They were like
to
all busy.
This?
They were like, you know.
And so yeah, like speaking to your early life with books, were you a reader from the get go? Do you have any
yes.
early memories?
Yes,
of books?
Yes. And I think we always talk about this in teaching that I think that there is no such thing as a natural writer. I think it is all just a natural reader, and you have read so many things that by the time you sit down to write, you already kind of have a knowledge of how sentences should look and sound. Like, you have an ear for it. Unless maybe you're William Faulkner and you're writing things. But I see, because I teach adults too, and the amount of people who want to write who have never read, it's so strange to me. Yeah. I'm like, the only reason I ever wanted to write because I loved books. I was a reader. So that's
my theory as to why a lot of movies suck now, is because, like, I don't think the people writing these movies read books.
There's something so arrogant and annoying of being like, I should write. And what have you read that you liked? Nothing. It's like so weird.
But I know that the character has to save the cat in the first five pages.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it's so formatted. I also think, like, the drugs people are taking in each age affect the art that's getting through.
What's the drugs,
like,
right now?
I feel like 5 years ago it was just Adderall, and we're like, why is everything so fast?
But I feel like that's true. I think the amount of friends of mine who text me and they're like, I think I have ADHD and I might be autistic. And I'm like, okay, I think you've been on TikTok. Not that maybe you are, but.
I get relieved. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, that. Because I have a lot of friends who are, like, seemingly on the spectrum. I think in comedy, there's a lot of reasons why that.
I always say the men, no offense.
Yeah.
The women always have, like, 20 jobs and are, like, so together. And then men are always, like, living in their, like, car.
Yeah. And I'm just like, why do I have all these friends? It's not like my parents. And then I'm like, oh, okay, my parents probably, yeah. I find, like, I don't know, like, it puts people into context a little more, if I understand. Like you were saying, Gen Z know all their problems.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like, I like that.
Yeah,
it's
me
like,
too.
Yeah, give me your self-diagnosis so I can not take anything you're
I
saying
I also just
to
think,
like,
right giving
now.
Each other grace, yeah, of like, I mean, I'm somebody who, for better or worse, I always assume that people like me, you know? So
nice.
I think
I don't know. Go on. What's this like?
Just meaning, I think I normally, if someone's in a bad mood, I'm like, oh, they're probably going through something, as opposed to they don't like me. And I feel like I have a lot of comedian friends who are always like, so-and-so was big-dogging me, not saying hi to me. And I was like, I think that person was just
going through
living their life, and it wasn't about you personally. And there are probably people who really dislike me, and I'm like, that guy's just having a bad day.
That's amazing. What an amazing trait to get through life with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly very sensitive to people being angry at me, but for the most part, I always assume that I'm sort of, that people will like me. And then I think maybe I give off a vibe that I assume that. Whereas I think if someone assumes that people won't like them, they give off a real standoffish vibe, and then it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing for like
no,
close to 40 years.
You're very likable and everybody, you're very charming.
Well, I do a lot of work to try to win people over.
He's staring in the mirror going,
you're charming, they're gonna like you.
Well, and I can see
if they hate you, find a way to hate yourself in a way that they're gonna like.
I can see. Oh, and trust me, I'm self-loathing, but I think it's also how you were raised. Like,
yeah.
I grew up with a lot of like loud personalities.
Okay.
And it was my job to be sort of like, I was like, not only class
back?
Clown but family clown.
Family
yeah
clown. So
yeah
you have
yeah
to be even louder.
No, like funny, soothing,
sneaking
laid
in.
Back. Yeah, like make everybody kind of really, you know, my dad is kind of an anxiety disorder. Not kind of. He's in his 70s, so he would never call it. He'd call it like agita, you know. It's like only when I grew up, I was like, oh, other people's dads aren't crying when they can't put together Legos. You know, I just assumed that you think whatever you grow up
that
with
that
is.
That was just a side effect from rationing during World War II.
Yeah, you think it's normal, but I mean, now, if my dad was Gen Z, he would be like, I have a debilitating anxiety disorder. But because he's in his 70s, he's like, you know how I get.
Yeah.
I get worked up, you know. And my mom will be like, you know how dad gets. He gets worked up.
Oh, my God. And which one's better? Who can say? I tend to like all the labels, but I always say, like, if a house is burning, you need to be able to describe it to the fire department, as you call 911.
Oh, that's such a nice
but
way
like,
to say it.
But like, if you don't have words for it, you'd call 911,
and
you're
like,
"I'm
burning,
hey,
I'm burning."
Happening.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I feel like of what I've read of yours, I feel like I think. Correct me if I'm wrong.
They're all tweets, so
no. But you've read kind of. I've read small short stories,
yeah,
like maybe
so.
Flash fiction. And
yeah,
you do have a very particular narrative voice that I think is like writing that line between like. I want to be dead, and yet I continue. Nevertheless, he persists. Yeah, in a really funny, kind of charming way.
Yeah, I once had a therapist say she admired my resilience, and I like was like, you know what, I'll take that.
That's
I'll take
so
that
nice.
Because, yeah, I don't.
I asked my therapist before New Year's, I was like, am I your favorite client? And she was like, I'll say that I like spending time with you. And I was like, I'll take it,
You'll
baby.
Take it.
I made the mistake of recommending my therapist to another comedian, Megan Gailey, who's so charming. And now I'm always like, fuck, I'm in competition with Megan. I just feel in competition.
Yeah.
She'll be like, Dr. Barbara sent me a baby gift. I'm like, fuck, I have to have a baby. I got to get in competition with Dr. Barbara.
I did the thing where I couldn't afford real therapy, so all my therapists are like Gen Z.
Oh, they're like in school.
Yeah, they're finishing their hours, so sliding scale, it's cheaper. And they're all like...
younger than you.
They're younger than me, and they're like, that reminds me of a TikTok I saw. And I'm like, hey, can you just talk about Sigmund Freud for 1 second?
And then they see... Yeah, you see them on TikTok.
Yeah, they said they saw me on their
partner's TikTok.
They
see you, you
TikTok.
See them.
They're
I overheard your
voice on my partner's TikTok.
You're like, don't tell me that, dude.
Don't tell me that.
Yeah.
Just analyze.
Yeah, I've
dreams.
Had some real bad therapists in the past. A lot of people just become therapists.
They do.
And it seems like all you have to do to become a therapist, same as real estate agent, is
it's
just
an
like
exit
decide.
Route.
Yeah, and just one day be like, I'm a therapist.
I'm a therapist.
I know people go to school sometimes, but.
No, they go to school for it, but you definitely.
But now you can also
say
you're like a life coach and you don't necessarily need to be.
Right.
I had one who she gave me a Playmobil stop sign to stop negative thinking. She was an elderly woman.
Okay.
And then the next week she gave it to me again. I was like, bitch, you already
gave me
this.
Oh, no. She forgot she gave
she
it to
forgot.
You.
She forgot.
My sister had one who fell asleep. A life coach is like.
I feel like that's a new thing. Like the life coach is kind of a modern, a contemporary.
And I know some people who are. And I don't know. Maybe they have the wisdom from dealing with their own dysfunction. They could recognize every.
Or maybe it's that old thing. You can't tell yourself what to do, but you could tell somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I give advice all the time that I'm like to younger girls and stuff that I'm like, why don't I fucking take this?
take your advice. Yeah. I'm out of the advice game.
I'd take advice from you.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I did try to give you that little bit earlier about maybe you should write towards someone that you...
And I like that advice, okay. And I'm going to...
So I sneak it in, I guess, but...
Yeah.
What else have you brought?
Okay.
I'm excited to see your pile.
Play It As It Lays is the only one in this pile that I think is not considered the female comedic voice.
Okay.
I just remember when I read Joan Didion, okay? I had to have been like... 18, 19. I lived in Southern California in the suburbs, and I just thought that it was like a truer version of California than I myself had been living, which was like in the parking lot of Olive Garden and like at the mall, you know? And hers, I was like, this is what it means to be Californian. A lot of like staring at a palm tree and thinking that tree is dead, you know? And like a lot of my early writing was, I think, imitating her very bad. This noir sort of, I just think the style influenced me for a really long time. True minimalism, really kind of sinewy prose, they say. And maybe one of the, also a book about gambling, one of the most depressing books. I like the chapters, how short they are. Even now when I'm having trouble with my novel, I open this and think, oh, a chapter can be 1 to 2 pages. It's marked up because I taught it recently. But have you read it?
I actually just read it like 2 months ago.
And?
Yeah, it just devastated me. It put me in
it's
such
devastating.
A horrible mood. But like in a way that I appreciated. She's so cold, calculated. She sees things in a very frank manner. She sees things in an unvarnished way. She clearly understands more than everyone in the room.
Yeah.
She doesn't, but like she's detached. She's emotionally detached from it.
Yeah, and I like that the plot is sort of like collaged of these experiences. I'm actually always trying to get away, I think, from this natural tendency I have to write kind of cold and Southern Californian.
Yes.
You know, because I don't want to write, even like Sally Rooney, who I admire, I want a little bit more warmth and feeling and vulnerability in my writing. I think I don't like when my writing gets too cool. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that actually is really interesting to think about. Is that what became the style because everything here was so sunny and warm? You the writers had to,
I just think I admire that coolness. I don't know. And I think it's hard to be really vulnerable.
The LA writers all kind of fit that mold.
Yeah.
Like, even thinking of Chandler, it's like he's the cool noir detective.
Oh, yeah.
Everything rolls off his back because he's so fatalistic anyway.
That's so interesting. I think you could make a case for it being like a Southern Californian type. I just know that the books I'm most moved by, and when I'm moved by my own writing, it's stuff that I feel like is a little bit embarrassing, even though it's fiction.
Yes.
It's stuff that I'm like, oh, I can't believe I knew that. You know, when you've written well and you get to the end of a story and you're like, I didn't even know that I knew that. Like,
yes.
Where did that come from?
Yes.
I think that. I also just think saying stuff that I would be embarrassed to admit out loud. And I think sometimes when writing is really cool, I don't break through that, like, membrane.
Yeah, and that's what I feel Didion's limitations
yes,
are.
Yes, I agree.
Like, you're not showing a vulnerability that brings me in closer. Have you read any Jonathan Ames?
He had a TV show
called Bored to Death on HBO.
Oh, I like that show.
But yeah, so he wrote.
My dad's always like, you can't finish your novel. You're like that guy in Bored to Death. I'm like, Larry.
You know that show that had 3 seasons 15 years ago. You're
and
like
then he's always like, you should write Game of Thrones. I'm like, that's a book already. What am I going to write?
Finish the series.
He's like, more dragons. And of course, everything I write is about him. You know,
your dad.
Probably. Yeah. In one way or another.
Yeah.
Trying to soothe some difficult man.
Hey, that's endless. Right?
That's endless, baby.
Well, Joan Didion, Laurie Moore.
Laurie Moore.
Okay, so I've read those two, which is amazing.
Yeah, what do you think of Laurie Moore?
Yeah, I love her. Yeah, I think she's one of my favorite short story writers. I've tried reading her novels and haven't been able to, like, go with them. I think it would take some work, whereas her short stories don't take
this
work.
Is what I worry about myself, that she's like a true short story writer because she is so voice driven that the plot is like beside the point, and in the short stories that doesn't matter so much, but in the novels
maybe she feels that pressure too and has to go more plot heavy than she needs, because a lot of books don't really need
listen, if my agents would have let me sell a collection of short stories before a novel, I would have.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I respect them and I love them. Okay.
Is the thinking behind that like you want to debut with a novel? And
the thinking behind that is that people don't read short stories.
Really?
And that novels make more money.
No
that
kidding.
Collections are really difficult to, people do it, but they prefer, this is like business talk, so I feel like this is really boring, but they prefer you to sell a novel first and then follow it up with a short story collection.
Okay.
I think maybe unless the novel does terribly and then... but really, the average sales for novels are only 5,000 copies.
Yeah, I've heard if you can do more than 5,000, you're
and you're
like
just
golden.
Trying to sell through that advance. I mean, you know, you've really failed if you can't sell through the advance. But that's
well,
why I think sometimes
for now.
Yes,
but, you know.
Books, yeah, I shouldn't say really failed, and I think that's why it's maybe a curse. A gift and a curse to get a huge advance. I did not get a huge advance.
Okay, good. So you're,
so
cursed. Like Judd Apatow made this collection of short stories called I Found This Funny, and I read it in the airport or whatever. And he had this really funny, interesting opening. In his opening remarks in the book, he said, so I'm not a big reader, so I like to read short stories. And when I pick up a short story book, I look for the shortest short story and I start there. And I was like, I feel like more people should think that way, especially with our attention spans.
I do think a lot of people read flash fiction online.
Okay.
And I think when I'm teaching a class where people want to know kind of like, where do I start? I'm like, I think you should try to publish a piece of flash fiction, which is 750 words and under usually. There's all these blurred genres. Some people say microfiction, but it could also be prose poetry, which I feel like you're into. Like these really short kind of... It's so nice to just finish something.
Oh, yeah.
And you can write it kind of in one sitting.
Yeah, I think that's always been my problem as a writer is I just like... Once I finish, I would just want to be done with it.
Oh, I'm
like,
always...
Oh, you actually can't.
Amy Hempel has this line where she talks about how some writers think that people are sitting there listening to them and they could go on forever and ever. And she always assumed that people want to be away from her. So she's got to say it quick and get off the page. And I assume that people want to get away. I think also how I grew up, nobody was ever listening to me and I had to talk really quickly and be interesting or funny.
Right.
And I think that really affects my writing is nobody was sitting there being like, talk,
tell
Amy.
Me more.
Yeah, tell me more. I had to get it in and quick.
Well, the internet hasn't helped either. I mean, with Twitter, which you and I have been on way too long, it's like, you know, you can see it in action. You're like, I just gave a thought and no one's responding to it and I need to do better or else why am I putting thoughts out there? It's like in real time.
I know. Do you think about kind of, I'm always struggling with this idea of that the internet is bad for me, like my head, my concentration.
I totally disagree. No, yeah, no, it's horrible.
My ability to think through things on my own.
Yeah.
I think it's, yeah, and it's, but then it's for our jobs, it's hard not to. It's also like shouting into the void. Sometimes you want to hear back from someone.
Yeah, and so there's the thrill is when you do hear back. You're like, oh, great, I like connected. I think it's so surreal, like to, if you were to make a movie, you'd be lucky if you did, and it would take 7 years is the average movie. And if you wanted to license a Rolling Stones song for it, you couldn't unless you had hundreds of thousands of dollars to do it. But I can make a TikTok and put a Rolling Stones song to it right now, and it's like, cool, I just made a film with a Rolling Stone.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, so there is that gratification.
And people watch it and they feel something.
Yeah.
Even though it took 10, yeah.
I actually think like the little videos that have, little bit of video success I've had on the internet has like pretty much satisfied the need to be heard, which is kind of like dangerous.
Cause
all right, so you're not going to do anything then because you've been heard.
And but like, people maybe. Could argue that you have been doing something with those, that, that they sit in someone's head.
No, the spiritual component's been fulfilled. I bridged that gap between your loneliness and mine for a moment, and that was what I set out to do.
Yeah.
Do I need to get paid for it? No, no. Send me on my way.
That's like I will work so long and hard on a short story, you know, and then I get paid my like $400. It goes into like the Colorado Review or something, probably read by like three people, and then some dumb tweet goes like viral about how I eat one big meal in the middle of the day like a snake, and I'm like, what is, you know, life is so long and strange,
and they've been paying the short story writers the same amount of money
for forever.
Like John Fontaine, Ask the Dust, he's like, and I sold the story for
$150.
I
had a short story in Best American Short Stories, and it was on Best American Short Stories, the anthology goes on the bestseller list for a long time. I didn't see any extra money or royalties for how many Best American Short Story anthologies they sold.
No royalties for that?
No, I think it goes to the, not even to the editor, who was Roxane Gay at that time. Shout out to Roxane Gay, the best.
Yeah.
I don't know who it goes to, but it doesn't go to her, and it doesn't go to the writers.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing thing to be in there.
Yeah, no, trust me, and I would love to be in again. Powers that be.
Is there any job that pays way less than minimum wage, more prestigious than being
than,
a writer?
Then writing fiction, too, I think, specifically.
Teaching,
maybe?
Yeah, teaching. Oh, yeah.
No, but teaching's fun. I'm like doing bits on them when I teach college. And
so
if they laugh, I'm
in.
Like writing it down. So yeah.
Open mic, you're getting paid.
Oh, yeah, totally. I'm like, did you guys think that was funny?
Write a paper about it.
Oh, yeah.
And give me some suggestions.
And they all watch my stand up. They're all like, you know. They're demented.
That's cool. So it feels like very collaborative.
Oh, one student, he couldn't figure out how to turn in a paper. He like didn't have my email address, so he was like commenting on my reels. He was like, oh, so funny. I'm 2 weeks late on the paper. I was like, what is happening?
I faved this if you can buy me a little time.
Yeah. He's like, got a flat tire.
Oh, my God. So you brought up Amy Hempel. I don't know anything about her.
Amy
Is
Hempel.
There anything people would want to know about Amy Hempel?
Some people, look, signed
okay.
copy.
Well, I didn't know you were bringing in a signed copy.
I'll say this. This is not from this collection, but she has a one-line story that I think about every day of my life. If I were to get a tattoo, I'm not a tattoo person, I would tattoo it on myself. It's called Memoir. One line, it goes, just once in my life, oh, when have I ever wanted anything just once in my life? It's got this perfect M dash. Mm. Just once in my life, M dash. Oh, when have I ever wanted anything just once in my life? And it's called Memoir, and I think it explains me to myself. She has all these kind of one sentence short stories, and this is her latest collection. Some people say she's right there with when minimalism kind of became a thing with like Bartholomew, how do you say his name, and all those people.
She's of this era, or
she's alive. I just think when I'm feeling writer's block, I read her short stories that are sometimes one page, two sentences, and it just makes me think like, oh, it's all, I already have it inside me. I just got to open the valve. Mary Robeson, you ever heard of her?
No.
Why Did I Ever? One of the great, this is a novel and it's written all in these little tiny fragments.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, read that first chapter. Yeah.
I have a dream of working a combination lock that is engraved on its back with the combination. Left 85, right 12, left 66. Well, shit, man, I say in the dream.
Everything's like those tiny little fragments. And then by the time you get to the end, you realize all of this tragedy has befallen this woman. Her son was like beat up for a hate crime. And I think something's with her daughter. Anyway, but the entire thing is funny and moving. And at one point she's had many husbands and she just says she's trying to figure out why she's had so many divorces, and she says, I think the lighting was wrong, like something like that. And I read something recently that she had ADD, she thought, and most of this book was written in the car in parking lots. Like she would just kind of scribble down little note cards, and then by the end it was like she kind of put it together and she had this novel. And this is a book I read in a plane and I kept having to set it down because I just felt, you know when you have that feeling?
Yes.
Just like, ugh. Hurt, like it pains you,
yeah,
because it's so funny and good and you wish you'd written it.
Yeah That's a very particular,
I love the title too,
it's cast
why
on
did
me.
I ever,
and no question mark either.
No question mark.
Yeah.
No question mark. Why did I ever,
why did I ever, and that's a statement.
Yeah
No, I love little books.
They're almost like tweets. They could have been, she could have been great on Twitter, but thank God that she didn't have to.
Well, George Saunders, because I'll just keep referencing him, he said like, well, it doesn't make sense for me to be on Twitter. I get paid to think about things long and slow, and I'm like, fuck,
that's how I want to be. I throw this microphone. That's how I want to be thinking about things.
I wish I was born 20 years
long and slow. Just once in my life. Oh, when have I ever wanted anything just once in my life?
Yeah.
I always say too with stand up, like, I mean, I'm joking, but if you would have told me when I started that I would have to put up clips, you know, I would be like, take me back to the era when men were like honking your boobs and being like, get on stage, sweetie. I'd have my boobs honked if it meant I didn't have to.
No, you're
put
saying
up
nothing's
clips.
More degrading than putting up.
Yeah,
clips,
yeah,
of your,
I suppose.
Own,
and I'm sure there's something in between putting up clips and getting your boobs honked. So I am a feminist.
Utopia.
I wanted to say that to the audience.
There's a utopia somewhere. I like the clips just because I'm not good socially with people, and part of stand up is like being social and like part of a community.
Mm.
And so to me, it's like you get to kind of skip a step.
Mm.
But we've seen the damage that that does. People put up this internet content and then they go, they're like, yeah, and I guess I do stand up now.
Yeah, and then yeah.
And it's like people who invest so many nights, endless nights to this craft.
Of like getting on stage. I mean, I think I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I'm really bad at technology. It's like doesn't come naturally to me. I have to pay people to cut up sets. But as I get older, I'm kind of like, I'm just letting go of, I can only do what I do. My path is my path.
Any alternative path has been beaten out of me every time I try to step off my path.
And I'm like, sure, I'll pay someone $20 to cut up a stupid clip. You know, I'm not good at it.
Yeah. No, I mean,
I'm jealous of the people who technology seems to come naturally to them.
Yeah, it's its own skill. It's its own art form.
I write by hand a lot.
Oh, you do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like in a journal.
In notebooks and
yellow pads.
Yeah, and then I'll lose a notebook and I'm freaking out and then I have to track it down. You know, it's like,
it's a thing when you lose a notebook, you realize how embarrassing your thoughts are.
Oh, my God.
Because you panic. You're like, oh, my God.
A comedian
God,
had
I put
my
it on
notebook.
The top of my car.
A comedian had my notebook with like jokes in it, but it also had lists of things I was going to talk to my therapist about, like, you know, and gratitude lists where I'd written like Diet Coke and the sun.
I'll do free writes and I'll be like, okay, just say whatever. And you can be ugly to yourself. Like you can be so egomaniac. And then I just think, man, if someone found that,
right,
it would be the end.
But I do find like in writing a novel and feeling under pressure and like self-conscious and kind of tight, writing it on little notepads, it tricks me into thinking like, oh, this doesn't matter.
It's just you.
I can throw this away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a physical thing. You could see it.
Yeah.
I feel like that's, I think like, aside from the fact that they ask you for gratuity everywhere you go now, I feel like that's why people are, like, rebelling against tip culture, which I've worked in the service industry forever, so I take it very personally. Because, like, you don't get to write it anymore.
Yeah.
People want to see their own signature. There's a pleasure to filling out a check after you've had good service. And if someone just comes up and you're punching a button, it's different. And so, I mean, that just extends to everything in our lives.
Yeah.
But what else do you got? I don't want to leave any of these on the table.
Willful Creatures by Amy Bender.
Okay, Amy Bender.
A writer who's been really kind of instrumental in my life. And she teaches at USC and a mentor to me. And I do you like magical realism?
Who would be another example of magical realism?
Kind of the father of magical realism is Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It's where... Unlike fantasy, it's like the world looks like the world we know, but one thing is kind of
off,
magical.
Like, and with Marquez, it's like incest. Reigns supreme.
Like, she has a short story in here where a woman adopts a potato as her child. And then, not to ruin anything, but it's like when something happens to the potato, you feel more for the potato, you think, than you could for a human baby. Somehow it's and not all of my favorite short story in this off is not magical realism. It's A Girl at a Party. And I think when I read these stories, they gave me permission to think of myself as someone capable of producing literature.
Wow.
That I too had been to a party. I too had felt lonely. I too have thought about an ex, you know, and she's a really generous just workshopper person. When I felt like nothing I write is good, she will look at it and she can point to the exact sentence where you've kind of lost the thread. She'll be like, the language here is a little bit loose. Like, she doesn't even prescribe anything, but that alone, to know exactly where exactly at what point in the short story you've kind of lost it. Just an incredible person and writer, Amy Bender.
So they say never meet your heroes, but you did,
this,
and it worked out.
And
that's
sure.
That's so cool. And it's so cool how your experience of reading has integrated into your experience of writing, as it should, but it's cool that you've shared this with us.
Yeah, show me some of yours.
So I brought you two George Saunders stories because they reminded me of you, and he's also one of my favorites.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. George Saunders is, like, so generous. This book is, have you read it?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it's how he teaches his grad students about seven Russian masters short stories. And he walks you through it. And he's so compassionate and thoughtful when it comes to his nonfiction. And I've read The Brain Dead Megaphone, which is another collection of his. And then, like, his fiction is generally boils down to, what if we put a really stupid person in a dystopia and they didn't know it?
And it's I think the other thing about his fiction is it belies the skill. Like, it seems simple.
Right.
And so it's a lot of, like, my young male college students are always like, I love Civil War Land and Bad Decline, or they love David Foster Wallace. And they all think it's sort of, like, simple.
Right.
And then in reality, you're like, no, this guy's a fucking genius.
Right.
That's how he was able to do that.
You meet people in L.A. who are like, I want to write. I'm writing a show. It's going to be like our version of Seinfeld. You know, me and my friends hanging out. And it's like, you have no idea how hard that is to make interesting to other people.
Who was it, the famous writer who said, easy reading is hard writing?
Yeah.
I think like Maya Angelou or something.
It really seems like there's a conversion between the writer's pain to the reader's pleasure.
Right.
And that's why the guy who wrote Game of Thrones, he's like, no, I'll just open a movie theater in New Mexico and chill out. And like,
I also think you can tell when writers are like having fun, and George Saunders always seems like he's having fun. Same with these stories of Amy Bender. She talks about she'd been in grad school. She'd been like working on these like kind of heavy, torturous short stories. And then she had a teacher, I think, who said, and she does this in her workshops, he wanted everyone to turn in an extra short story that was short and just for fun. And those ended up being the short stories that turned into, I think, her first collection, because they were fun. They were like little fairy tales.
They were coming from a real source of enthusiasm.
And I think part of it is like, for writers, how do you trick yourself into thinking that what you're working on is the fun thing?
Yeah, after you've beaten all the fun out of yourself by the very act of just sitting alone in a room.
And I wonder if that's like what TikTok has become for you, is like the fun thing.
Yeah, for a second.
Yeah, and then anything that gets, I know. I'm like, anything, what the best way to hate something is to dedicate your life to it. I think I started stand-up as like a hobby to get out of writing, and now I'm like, why am I traveling to Wisconsin to do the Comedy Cabin, you know? How has this become half my career?
It's really true. Yeah, I don't think we're actually meant to have careers, but we're just doing them anyway.
So, I mean, same with writing. I only ever wanted to sell a novel, and then I'm like, why am I always complaining?
Yeah.
I got the thing that I wanted. And now I think I worry so much about it being squandered away.
Yeah. I mean, you enter these scenarios you think are dreams, and then you're like, oh, no, there's just a whole new world of anxieties here.
Totally.
And I'm going to look like an asshole for thinking, yeah, for feeling this.
Yeah, I feel like it requires, all of the stuff that I like to do requires some looseness, but then it's hard when you care so much about something to infuse that looseness.
Yeah.
I go, relax, Amy. Be loose.
That's what I told myself. Psychopaths win.
Loose. Be loose. I teach like these extension classes, UCLA extension, those type of things, where old people take them people far along in their years.
People of lacking youth.
People of lacking youth. And there's always sometimes this thing at the beginning where these old dudes will be like, you look like my granddaughter, you know? And I'm like, I don't know what to tell you, dude. I have a PhD.
Right.
I've been writing longer than you have because you were a lawyer and you just, you know, decided one day that you would write.
Sort of a way of trying to kind of.
I don't think they're saying it as a rude way. I think they're wondering if they can trust me, that I look young, that I look like their granddaughter. How could I know more than they do when I am so much younger and when I'm like a 5-foot blonde woman.
I once had someone say to me, you should always have a mentor who's older than you and younger
than
you.
Yeah, I love that.
I love it too. Not to say that anyone wants to mentor me, but just the idea that you could learn something from people of all ages.
Well, and I do think you see older people who are really in touch with the youth and kind of respect what they have to say. Maybe with a little, I think there's nothing worse than the like, get off my lawn. What are these young
same? And you see that with
doing
artists. That's when they die. John Waters says he sends young people to events and has them report back to him so that he can understand what's going on with the youth without actually having to be the old guy at the party.
When I'm like teaching college, I forget to teach anything because I'm like, what did you guys do this weekend? You know?
Talk to me.
And I'm also like trying to set them up on dates and being, I think I have small woman privilege.
Okay.
Where
if I was a man,
the stuff I say where I'll be like, you know, I'm trying to set them up, I'm being crazy. If I were a man, I'd be like arrested. But because I'm a small woman, they're like, she's not going
to
kill us.
I've had women say that to me. They're heterosexual women. They're like, you know, the things that a guy does toward you, it's all a matter of whether you're attracted to
them. I think that's true too.
It's like certain gestures could be read in two totally different ways, and I'm going to choose it.
You never seen a handsome man be accused of being creepy the way ugly men are.
Yeah, he's got to work twice as hard.
Yeah, to be creepy. Yeah, yeah.
Do you let your students vape in your class?
No.
No.
But no one's ever tried to vape. I do a thing where, like, you know, it's when I first started teaching, and I've been teaching for a while, I just remember I would like dress up in a blazer, you know, like you're trying to
be a professor.
Yes. And I was nervous, and I think I was way stricter. And then as time has gone on, I'm like, I look like them. I'm wearing like a big backwards cap. I don't feel the need to like prove to them that I'm knowledgeable. I just am knowledgeable.
Right.
For the most part, I think their lives are busy. They're stressed. Half of them, you know, they're going through a breakup or they're fighting with their mom. And I try to be understanding of like, if you didn't turn something in, like here's a little leeway, here's a little looseness without being too much their pal.
Right.
So I think that's always the line.
Wanting to maintain structure.
Yeah. And just, I don't want to ruin anyone's like GPA because they like had a terrible semester where they were depressed.
Yeah.
So I try to take into account, I think you can tell quickly too if they come talk to you and are like, this is what I'm going through, versus just a kid who never shows up, and when he shows up, he looks like hungover.
Right.
But then sometimes I'm hungover. So I'm like, I get it. You know?
Yeah.
Our gap is still pretty small. And I think, when I'm teaching, I'm always like, I don't want to be teaching. I'm a writer. You know, I'm a writer who has to teach. I'm not a teacher. And then when I stop for a few semesters, I miss it. It gives my life. I think it's hard being a writer and a comedian to not get a little bit self-absorbed and a little bit like in your head. And I think, yes, I'm being paid to teach, but not enough. It reminds me to, I don't know, be more generous with like my time and listen to them and what they're going through, read their dumbass writing, you know?
That sounds amazing. It sounds like you just have this really cool balance of input and output and
Well, that's nice of you to say. Service. Amazing and, how much reality TV I can manage to watch and how late my fucking book is.
How late is your book?
Watch me on Instagram and I know that they're like, why is she going to
Wisconsin?
Yeah, or we're like, why is she going to Bakersfield? You know?
Right.
At least Wisconsin, I was paid pretty okay. In Bakersfield, it's like $30 and a beer, you know? Damn. They gotta be like, what is she up to?
Bakersfield's worth it because they have amazing Basque food.
Really?
Yeah, like there were a lot of Basque sheep herders who came over there at some point historically. And so there's these restaurants with like 9-course meals with like spaghetti and French fries and
also
beef
great
tongue.
Crowds.
Oh,
like they're fun because it's like I think in places where there's not a million comedy clubs, it's like the people, you know, it's like a don't tell.
Yeah. Well, gosh,
what's left for us?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like this
will
an
become of
conversation.
Us?
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming in. I think this was a great conversation. We're lucky to have you.
Oh my God, what a pleasure to talk about books. You know, I know you that you still have a serious girlfriend.
Yeah.
But I feel like the women at home are looking at you. Or men, or non-binary, and are looking at you and thinking, "Oh, this is a catch. He's a cute guy who talks about books, and I have a cute boyfriend, but he does not read books.
No,
I don't think he's ever read a book in his life."
Yeah, they say the majority of readers are women, and
yes.
I hope they're thinking that just because it would be a joy to talk about books for my life.
Yes,
I think solid there.
Can I say one last thing? This is what I always say to my students at the end of every semester, and I know that the podcast is not my classroom, but that when you like watch TV and do all that other stuff, you feel like you've wasted time. But when you read a book, you always feel like you've created time. It seems to expand time. And if you spent your whole life reading, or at least for me, if I spent my whole life reading, I would feel that it was a life well spent. A life in books is a life well spent. All right.
Amen. No, what a...
You like man, that?
That is... just about a perfect way to close out this show. We'll just stack up all our books. So,
I know, my books.
Yay.
My books. I love my books.
Yeah. All right. Amy Silverberg, Dr. Amy Silverberg, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was
so fun. This was so fun.